Hello, and welcome to the first and what will become a regular feature, a podcast summary of our activities in supporting consistent application in the last quarter. As a way to make our work more accessible and visible, we plan to record a podcast every quarter, summarising discussions by the Interpretations Committee, as well as any other related activities that might be of interest. So this podcast will cover the most recent committee meeting in June 2019 and a number of other topics of relevance. I'm Patrina Buchanan, a member of the ISB's technical staff, and I'm joined today by Sue Lloyd, Vice Chair of the Board and Chair of the Interpretations Committee. So the most recent committee meeting took place on the 11th and 12th of June in London. The committee discussed 13 topics, as well as an administrative paper on matters reported to the board. So let's start with where the committee decided to publish agenda decisions. For four of the topics discussed, the committee considered comments letters received on tentative agenda decisions and decided to finalise those agenda decisions. The topics were holdings of cryptocurrencies, classification of pension plans, cost to fulfil a contract when revenue is recognised over time, and whether a particular contract contains a lease. So Sue, I'm going to ask you first of all to comment on holdings of cryptocurrencies. We received a lot of comments on this topic. It's something the board has already discussed several times, and so maybe you could comment on both the board's work as well as the committee's work on this topic.
Okay, thanks Patrina. So yes, firstly, let's put the agenda decision in context. So the board's discussed on a couple of occasions whether to add a standard setting project on crypto assets or a subset of those assets, such as cryptocurrencies. And we've also discussed it at board meetings with our Accounting Standards Advisory Forum and the Interpretations Committee. Now, last November, the board was asked to make a decision on whether or not to add a project on crypto assets or currencies at this stage. And the board decided not to do it. We decided it was perhaps a little bit too early, but we'd actively monitor developments in the market. But the board also asked that the committee consider whether they should publish an agenda decision in response to feedback from stakeholders that said there's a live question today about accounting for holdings of cryptocurrencies, and it would be helpful to confirm what the existing requirements are. So the committee's agenda decision isn't a substitute for any standard setting that the board might do at some particular point in time, but rather a response to clarification of what you do today based on our existing standards. Now, this is a hot topic. It attracts quite a lot of interest. So we've got quite a few comment letters for a tentative agenda decision, 20. And most of those giving us comments agreed with the technical analysis on how the existing standards would apply. Many went on to say they still think it would be a good idea if the board undertook more standard setting, and we're going to update the board on that. But in summary, the committee decided to confirm the current accounting for those holding cryptocurrencies, basically saying that if an entity holds cryptocurrencies and it meets the definition of an inventory, that apply IAS 2, and for all other holdings, IAS 38 applies.
Great, thank you. I'll also just highlight the agenda decision on IFRS 16, and it specifically addressed the definition of a lease. So the question asked was about a particular contract for subsurface rights. So the contract gave the customer rights to use specified space under the ground, in this case to be used for a pipeline. Now, in concluding that the contract contains a lease, the committee noted that the specified underground space is tangible and is an identified asset in the same way that specified space on the surface of the ground or on land is tangible and is an identified asset. So although you may not have this particular type of contract, I think the agenda decision really sets out a useful analysis of kind of how to go about thinking about applying the definition of a lease to any contract. On the other two finalised agenda decisions, I'll say only that they provide information firstly about classifying a pension plan, and really in particular noting the importance of looking very closely at the terms and conditions of a plan, as well as a company's informal practices that might give rise to constructive obligation. And finally, the recognition of costs, and particularly when you're recognising revenue over time. So moving on to tentative agenda decisions. And here the committee published tentative agenda decisions on 7 new topics. These are all now out for comment. And just as a reminder, a committee publishes a tentative agenda decision when it concludes that standard setting is not needed, having applied the decision-making criteria in the due process handbook. So for all 7 of these, the committee's initial conclusion is that standard setting isn't needed because the principles and requirements in the standards provide an adequate basis for an entity to determine the appropriate accounting. So in asking for comments on these tentative decisions, we're really asking 2 things. Firstly, whether you agree with the committee's conclusion that standard setting is needed, and secondly, whether you agree with the technical analysis in the tentative agenda decision. So Sue, I'm going to ask you to comment on some of these.
Okay, so firstly, the committee received 2 questions to do with leases, so the application of IFRS 16, which is a pretty new standard. And also one of the tentative agenda decisions on leases also touches on the application of IAS 16, so the older property plant and equipment standard. And the first question that we talked about was the definition of a lessee's incremental borrowing rate, and specifically whether that rate must reflect the rate on a loan with a similar payment profile to the lease. So what does that mean? Basically, the question was being asked would be, if, for example, I entered into a 5-year lease, must the rate that I select as an incremental borrowing rate reflect a 5-year amortizing loan rate? Or could it be a 5-year bullet loan rate? So what does it mean? So on that question, the committee looked at the definition of an incremental borrowing rate in the standard and noted that it refers to the rate the lessee would have to pay to borrow over a similar term to the lease term in a similar economic environment with similar security, etc. And that a lessee would use the best information available to it and then adjust that information in applying that definition. So this means that the rate a lessee would estimate might often reflect an amortizing loan rate. However, the definition does not explicitly require that an amortizing loan rate be used. The second question we got was on lease term, and specifically the requirement in paragraph B34 of IFRS 16 that states that a contract is no longer enforceable when each party to the contract has the right to terminate the contract without permission from the other party, with no more than an insignificant penalty. Now, quite a long paper, but it all really just turned on a pretty straightforward question on the face of it, which is, what does the word penalty mean? And whether penalty should be read as being a relatively narrow term, referring only to any contractual termination payments in the contract, or whether it should be read in its wider sense to take into account the broader economics of the contract and the lessee's situation. So what did the committee say? They noted that the word penalty isn't defined in IFRS 16, but if you pick up a dictionary and look at the definition of penalty, it reflects a broader economic perspective. The committee then noted that the basis for conclusions supports this reading, explaining that the broad economic view of penalty is exactly what the board's objective was when developing the requirements on lease term. Now, there was a second part to the question, and that asked about how you think about the useful life of leasehold improvements and that how that interacts with your determination of the lease term. So what does that mean? Again, to try and make it simple to understand, let's say that I've entered into a 5-year lease with extension options, and I choose to spend quite a significant amount of money on leasehold improvements that could last for 10 years. How do I think about the useful life of the leasehold improvements when I apply IAS 16? Now, the committee noted the link between the determination of the lease term and the useful life of any non-removable leasehold improvements. So basically, in summary, IFRS 16 requires you to consider the expected utility of significant leasehold improvements when you're determining a lease term and looking at whether or not it's reasonably certain that you'll extend beyond the 5-year term in my example. And IAS 16 requires consideration of the expiry dates of related leases when you determine the useful life of leasehold improvements. So there's interactions, I guess, between the two standards. And the tentative agenda decisions basically outline these considerations. Moving on to another one of the tentative agenda decisions, and this is to do with disclosures of changes in liabilities arising from financing activities. And this was a really interesting question for the committee, because this is the first submission we'd ever received from the investor community. And the question was about the disclosure requirements in IAS 7. Now, these are quite new disclosure requirements that were added to IAS 7 relatively recently to provide information to investors about cash flows and the financing of a company. The tentative agenda decision sets out some helpful reminders about what those requirements say and how a company should go about achieving the stated disclosure objectives in IAS 7. Moving on to one of my favourite topics, hedge accounting. We had a question about fair value hedges of foreign currency risk on non-financial assets. So the committee looked at a question on fair value hedge accounting and more specifically, whether you can hedge a foreign currency risk component of a non-financial asset. So say, for example, I own an aeroplane, can I hedge foreign currency risk in my aeroplane? In this case, the tentative agenda decision doesn't provide an answer to any particular fact pattern, but it outlines more generally how to go about applying the relevant requirements in IFRS 9 on fair value hedge accounting. The analysis confirms that it can be possible to achieve hedge accounting when the non-financial asset is priced globally in a single currency. The tentative agenda decision then goes on to remind companies that to achieve hedge accounting in IFRS 9, the hedge needs to be consistent with the company's actual risk management objective and its strategy for managing exposure. So putting it simply, it isn't enough to be able to identify a foreign currency related asset on the balance sheet and to see a foreign currency denominated liability in the same currency and say, well, I'm going to apply hedge accounting. You actually need to be able to establish a risk management link between those two items. The last tentative agenda decision I'll mention is on IFRS 15, and this was to do with what you do where you have got a compensation that needs to be paid for delays or cancellation. And the particular question that we got was relating to airlines that are required by law to pay flight customers if the flight is delayed or cancelled. And the committee concluded that such compensation is part of the transaction price, so it should be treated as variable consideration when you apply IFRS 15. And that's because the compensation directly relates to the promise that the airline has made to a customer in its contract for the flight. So it directly relates to the airline's performance obligation. It's not just saying I'm going to get you sometime, someday, you know, in the next year from Munich to London. It's saying that on this day, by this time, you'll get there. If the flight's delayed or cancelled, the airline's failed to get me the promised flight service, and so any compensation for not doing so is a variable consideration.
Great. Thank you, Sue. So Sue's just talked about five of the tentative agenda decisions now out for comment. And I'll just briefly say that the final two tentative agenda decisions relate firstly to the presentation of liabilities or assets that relate to uncertain tax treatments. So those assets or liabilities that you might recognise and measure in accordance with IFRIC 23 on uncertain tax treatments. But this tentative agenda decision in this case just talks about presentation. So presentation on the balance sheet. And the final tentative agenda decision addresses subsequent expenditure on biological assets. So as I said, all seven of those are now open for comment for 60 days until the 20th of August. And we certainly encourage all of you with an interest in these to send comment letters to us. Now, in response to requests to be more timely to assist preparers actually using and applying our standards, we're working really hard to address questions as quickly as we can. And to do this, we need to analyse comments quickly, which means that in the papers that we bring to the committee, we can only analyse those comments received by the comment deadline of the 20th of August. So that covers off the agenda decisions and tentative agenda decisions. So I'm just going to move on now to a couple of other topics that the committee discussed in June. And in particular, I think it's worth mentioning some research work that's been done on what to do when you're applying IAS 21, covering foreign exchange rates, when there's actually a lack of exchangeability of currencies. So Sue, maybe you can talk about that.
Sure. So the staff and the committee have been doing what I think is some really interesting work on this topic of the exchange rate to use when you translate foreign currency transactions or the results of foreign operations where there's a lack of exchangeability. And this work's now reached the stage of being recommended by the committee to the board as a narrow scope project. So the next step, I guess, will be that the board will discuss the recommendations that have come via the committee. Now, this is a very, you know, real, alive question that that resulted from a question that was submitted to the committee a while ago about foreign operations in Venezuela. And some large multinationals that have got operations in Venezuela asked the committee whether applying IAS 21, you're required to use the official exchange rate that didn't reflect the economic situation, even when the foreign operation had next to no access to any foreign currency. So just because there's an official exchange rate, do you have to use it or not? And that question identified that there's a gap in IAS 21 and that the existing requirements assume that a company has access to foreign currency, and it doesn't state explicitly what to do when that's not the case. So in this project, if it's added to the board's work plan, would aim to fill that gap and propose some more requirements on what to do, sort of practically speaking, when exchangeability of a currency is lacking. Now, there's three parts to the possible proposals that we've been looking at. The first is to clearly define what we actually mean when we say that exchangeability is lacking, so when would it apply? We would strictly define when that is the case, and we don't want to develop requirements that would mean that companies could start to estimate exchange rates when observable rates exist. So we need to make sure that we've got the right population. The second part of the proposals would be to require a company to estimate the exchange rate when there's a lack of exchangeability. And the third would be to look at some appropriate disclosures to support the estimation process, because as you can imagine, if a company's had to estimate an exchange rate, it could, in some cases, have quite a big effect on the financial statements, and it would be really important for a user of financial statements to understand how the rate was determined and what assumptions had been made.
Great. So so more to come on this. As you mentioned, Sue, the next step will be to bring those recommendations to the board. I'd expect probably in the autumn timeframe. And at that stage, then ask the board whether it wishes to add a narrow scope project on exchangeability. And now finally, the committee also discussed a question on the sale of a single asset entity. On that topic, no decisions were made, and that one will come back again for further discussion. So that's really the committee meeting, a busy committee meeting, and maybe now I'll just move on to mention a couple of things that have happened in the last quarter outside the committee meeting. And the first thing I think that's worth mentioning is that in May, the board published an exposure draft including four annual improvements. As a reminder, annual improvements are really minor amendments to various standards, just to pick up where there might be some inconsistency or lack of clarity. And again, the comment period in that annual improvements exposure draft closes on the 20th of August. And finally, Sue, I think it might also be worth just mentioning two other items that are now available on our website, which is very much linked to our work in supporting consistent application. The first is, of course, your feature that talks about agenda decisions and is titled Time is of the Essence. And the second is an educational webcast on borrowing costs and revenue recognition.
Okay, sure. So firstly, this time of the essence, and perhaps it's useful to have a little bit of background on this. So as some of you may remember, we proposed some amendments to IAS 8 last year that were designed to try and assist entities making changes to their accounting policies as a result of agenda decisions coming from the committee. And the board In that document had noted in the basis for conclusions that the board's view was that people should be allowed sufficient time to implement a change in accounting policy when it arises from an agenda decision, because we know that it could take you time to gather the information you need and to get it to a state where it's at auditable standards, etc. And lots of people came back and said that was a really helpful comment, but it would be good to make it more visible. So we've been trying to find ways to do that. One of the ways that we're doing that is proposing including that observation in the revised due process handbook, which is out for comment at the moment. The other thing we've done is, if you read IFRIC update, the summary of the committee meetings, you'll see that we now start in that document by making the observation that the board has observed that sufficient time should be allowed to implement changes in accounting policy. Now, we did this to try and assist preparers and the market to sort of make a smooth and orderly transition, if you like, from what their old accounting might have been to improved accounting, reflecting what was in an agenda decision. But of course, as soon as we said, you know, sufficient time, people started to say, how long is sufficient? Which is a good question. So the article that's on the website written by me, Time is of the Essence, is really explaining what we were thinking there. And I think the main takeaway is that it's entity specific. It depends, it's focusing on how long do you need to take to implement the change. And also, I think most importantly, I've heard a lot of people quoting that it says we're thinking months, not years. And I've been telling people that's probably the main thing to remember when you read the article. But have a look at that. The other thing I think that's relevant that we have done is, after a recent agenda decision that was finalised, confirming what you do about the capitalisation of borrowing costs in circumstances where real estate developers are constructing multi-unit residential complexes and recognising revenue over time, a number of people said that the agenda decision was helpful, but it was quite complicated in a sense to understand the interaction between IFRS 15 and IAS 23. And so to assist people in that understanding, we've now put on our website an educational webcast that really walks through how this interaction is intended to work and the logic behind it.
Great, thank you, Sue. We've reached the end of our podcast. I would like to thank you all for listening to it. We hope you found it useful. And certainly please email communications@ifrs.org if you have any suggestions for improvement. Thank you and goodbye. Okay.